probably relief more than anything. I think you get very stressed out. You try not to let that go. But I don't know. I think it's just not only relief, but to know that you've done all that hard work, and she knows and I know that the effort and the time and all those little things that you do, and it's just so worthwhile to be part of someone else's journey and to know what it means to them and to yourself. Yeah, it's phenomenal to have that, and the reward is so high. Yeah, but it is very stressful, I won't deny it, especially the marathon in Tokyo.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives, careers and victories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories from some of the most interesting women across the state. As we come to the final few episodes of Herstory, there aren't many aspects of life we haven't covered. We've spoken to authors, musicians, journalists, activists, and farmers. But one glaring admission from our group of high achievers was a gold medalist. Luckily, Louise Savage makes up for that gap with her nine, yes, nine gold medals. She is one of the most decorated athletes our country has ever seen, also winning herself two silver and representing Australia at several international competitions, including this little thing called the Paralympics. In recent years, Louise has written a book, been named the Sportsperson of the Year several times over, and also coached current gold medalist in Madison Di Rosario to her recent victory at the Tokyo 2020 Games. It's episode 10 of Herstory with 2011 inductee Louise Savage. This is her story.
Louise Savage, and I could say maybe Paralympian and Paralympic coach.
So we'll get stuck straight in. Do you want to start by telling us a little bit about your family and your childhood? I know you were born and raised in Perth. What was childhood like for you?
Yeah, I grew up in Western Australia, was born in Subiaco there, and for me, I didn't really know any different. I think my family, you know, obviously I was physically different, but they didn't treat me any different and didn't put limitations on me to a certain extent. I went to a regular school with all the other children, but I was the only child with a disability. But yeah, it didn't really occur to my family that I probably couldn't do a lot of other things. I think a lot of those thoughts were put into my family's minds, but, you know, at the end of the day, they were like, oh, well, we'll just wait and see, hey? So I suppose for me growing up, I didn't have thoughts in my head that I couldn't do things, but it was fine. It was great. We were very sporty and just, I think, like everyone else in Australia. And I'm first generation Australian, so both my parents immigrated to Australia, and I think they just enjoyed the way of life here. And yeah, it was great.
Oh, what's not to love about being a sand groper, hey?
Yeah, no, it was a good place to grow up, definitely. Had a lot of great experiences, and representing my state, of course, was a highlight as well. So at a young age, I was very proud.
Louise, you were born with a congenital spine condition. Can you explain to us a little bit about what that was like when you realised that was what was going on in your life? And can you tell us what that actually means?
I don't actually have an official name, despite what you read on the internet, for my disability. It's a bit of a combination of this and that. So, yeah, it's where the spinal cord didn't form properly. A lot of people assimilate it to perhaps spina bifida, but mine was all internal. So if you know the spinal column at all, it's between probably T11 and T12, and I'm incomplete. So I do have some feeling and some muscles that work, but not enough to be able to weight bear or anything like that. So I have been in a chair my whole life. So, yeah, that was my disability. And, yeah, like I said, I had it from birth. So, yeah, I didn't know anything else than, you know, what I've got. And it's very similar to someone who, I suppose, has paraplegia and is either incomplete or complete and uses a wheelchair for mobility. Yeah, that's my disability.
So you said that your parents were pretty hell-bent on being a sport family. What did that look like for you? What were you in love with in sport as a child?
First of all, I was introduced into swimming, and that was to build up my upper body strength, and they thought that would be a great way of getting me, you know, a bit more mobile and as I said, build up my upper body strength. And that was with a lot of other children with similar disabilities. I have an older sister who is a very, very good swimmer, and then, you know, progression from that was we joined our local swim club, and that was my first love, I suppose, of any kind of sport. It wasn't until I was about 8 years old, I was introduced into wheelchair sports, and I think, yeah, the world turned upside down for me then. It was fantastic. So I think for me, yeah, I'm just a slightly competitive person. So definitely, I think once I found wheelchair sports and all the different options and things like that, it was fantastic and kept my love of swimming going for as long as I could as well.
You're a decorated wheelchair racer, and we'll obviously speak more on that shortly, but I imagine there was a bit of trial and error. Did you try many other wheelchair sports?
Yes. When I was first introduced, I had a go at just about anything and everything that I could get my hands on. I obviously did wheelchair basketball, wheelchair racing, athletics in terms of field events as well, the swimming, and there was another sport called slalom, which it was more about precision of, you know, being able to handle your chair and things like that. So I did everything that they had on offer, definitely through wheelchair sports, and loved every minute of it. And then I think just like any kid, you kind of try out different sports and figure out what you like best, you know, what you're good at and what you like and who your friends are, you know, involved with and like which sport, those kind of things. So I definitely gravitated towards wheelchair racing. I loved being able to go fast and see how far I could push myself. I mean, still kept up with swimming for a very long time.
Louise, when you were really getting into sport as a child, and when you were specifically finding this love of wheelchair racing, were there many role models? Were there other people you were looking to and saying, oh, that's who I want to be like?
Probably not growing up as much. You know, within our club, there are adults and a lot of other people older than me that were participating in the sport. So I looked up to them and obviously wanted to be as fast as them. But I definitely had a great role model, you could say, or a mentor in my first coach. And that was a guy called Frank Ponta. And he went to the first Paralympics ever in 1960. And he was my coach and couldn't have asked for a better mentor, really. He saw something in me that I didn't know existed. And growing up, I didn't know what the Paralympics were or anything like that. I had no clue. But he knew, and he knew how far I could go. And so he really encouraged me and taught me a lot about sport and sportsmanship. He was probably somebody that helped guide me definitely along the way and my path to becoming a great athlete. So, yeah, definitely Frank. And I suppose until I went to my first international competition, I think I really saw what my sport was all about. And then I saw some of the internationals and thought, right, yep. I want to be as good as them, yeah, if not the best.
Well, before the international stage, you started competing in wheelchair racing at the age of 8. At 10, you became the youngest ever athlete in the National Senior Paraplegic and Quadriplegic Games in Sydney. That's only a couple of years after really starting to get into and take it seriously. What was it like getting there to the national stage at 10?
Yeah, I suppose I didn't think anything of it until I got there, and then I was just so young compared to everyone else. But obviously they thought I was good enough and that I could go and compete at that level. Yeah, youngest on the team and then youngest when I got there. It was a bit like my first international competition, the same thing. I was the youngest on the team and then found out I was the youngest to compete. Yeah, I don't know. I just took it in my stride, I suppose, and had a lot of people that looked out for me, thank goodness. I'm sure you get into a bit of strife when you're 10 years old. And being away from my family and things like that at such a young age was probably a little bit difficult at the time, but I'm sure they saw it as a great opportunity to have a break from me. But yeah, it was just another adventure, I suppose, and being in something that I absolutely loved, and that was sport.
Was there a moment, Louise, where you thought, hey, this might actually be more than just something that I'm good at, but it might actually be a career and something that I can pursue forever?
I don't think that really occurred to me until after my first games, my first Paralympic games, where I thought, oh, wow, there are people that are doing this, you know, at such a high level year after year, and there could be a career path. And you know, I did turn to my family and say that I want to be a professional athlete, but, you know, I was very much discouraged at the time. There was no money in my sport and didn't exactly get a lot of sponsors or a lot of press or, you know, exposure. And, you know, I was a female athlete with a disability, and how was I ever going to make a living out of it? But it did happen, and, you know, they did become very proud of me. But, you know, it was a bit of a, I suppose, a turning point in not only my career but sport for athletes with a disability in general. And it's been kind of cool to be part of that journey and to see where it is now and what the athletes get and deserve, I believe, as well. Bit of a change there, but yeah, I suppose it wasn't, as I said, until my first international competition that I thought, this could be something that I'd love to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, isn't it? I feel like in the last few decades, at least in the last generation, has been the most expansion in athletes and professional sports, people with a disability who are competing as professional athletes. And like you said, being able to make a career and make a living off that as well. You've lived through that change. You were quite literally there competing as that change was happening. Do you look back now and think about time or I wish it didn't take that long for this to be treated as respected as it should be?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is fantastic to see the change and the public's perception and just the coverage that we get now for Paralympic Games on a commercial channel. And, you know, it was just phenomenal. I heard such amazing, you know, responses from the coverage from Tokyo, just Tokyo. But yeah, it's brilliant to see what the guys can get now. And, you know, not everyone can make a living out of it still, but there are some that are definitely breaking through. And that's fantastic. I mean, I scraped by and made a living out of it, but now they can really do it, which is just fantastic. And why shouldn't they? Work so bloody hard. So, I mean, I know what that involves, there being on both sides now. So, yeah, they do deserve it. They work hard to earn that. It's been fantastic to see the change and, as you said, be a small part in it.
It's one thing to be accepted and respected, but to be actively embraced as well is a whole nother level.
Yeah, I mean, they see the marketability in our athletes now and that people want to know, they want to see the sport. It's exciting. I mean, why shouldn't it be just like any other sport? It's fantastic, it's competitive, and to see the athleticism in the athletes, it's just phenomenal.
You mentioned there about hard work. Tell us a bit about what your training regime looked like, Louise. What kind of hours were you pulling? What kind of tasks were you doing when you were at the peak of competing?
Yeah, leading up to 2000, you know, the games in Sydney was probably the most taxing on me. I was doing between 11 and 12 sessions a week, and you just get so bloody tired. But I was in the race chair between 6 and 7 sessions. I also did, you know, lifting weights and some cross-training sessions with, you know, boxing, medicine ball work and hand cycling and things like that. So it was the ultimate, you know, I was so fit and so strong and, you know, I just really didn't let up. And so I've learned a lot from what I did as an athlete to what I do now as a coach and with my athletes and injury prevention and things like that, and more quality as opposed to quantity. There's a lot of lessons to be learned there along the way, but yeah, it was a lot of hard work, but it's obviously paid off and given the knowledge that we had at the time and resources that I had, you know, we did the best we possibly could. Facilities and a lot more of the resources available to us now are just so fantastic to be able to have access to. And I think it does mean that athletes have a lot more longevity in the sport. So good to see that change also.
Can you take us back to your first international competition? Do you remember when that was?
Yes. My first World Championships were in 1990 in the Netherlands, and I was injured in two races, the 100 and the 200 metres. And I ended up coming home with a gold medal in the 100 and a disqualification in the 200. I've definitely learnt my lesson about competition and things like that at that comp. But also, I suppose that was a bit of a turning point as well, seeing what my sport was all about and knowing that, you know, in 2 years' time after that, I could potentially go to my first Paralympics.
You were disqualified in the 200 metre for a lane violation.
Yes.
After crossing the line, you were in first place and then obviously not being able to take that home. That would have been absolutely devastating. I mean, how old were you in 1990, Louise?
Oh, that'll give away my age. But,
I'm sorry, I hate to break it to you, but it is online and it is available to Google.
Yes, I was very young. I did come out of my lane and deemed as, you know, taking a shortcut, and I did actually win that race. So it was quite devastating, but yes, extremely valuable lesson learned. And yeah, I competed in longer events after that as well. Yeah, no, it was a good experience. You know, it's really good to be able to have that stepping stone, I suppose, to even bigger stage of the Paralympic Games.
you have such a decorated career. You've had 9 gold medal wins, 2 silvers. You've represented Australia at 4 Paralympics. You also hold 2 Olympic gold medals, and you've also won the Boston Marathon 4 times. When you said they're some longer sort of races, I imagine marathons are what you're speaking about. What possessed you to say, hey, I'm going to give the Boston Marathon a crack?
I think you've got to be mad to do marathons in the first place, but... But yeah, I did change all my training. So I did compete on the longer distances on the track, so 800, 1500 and 5000, and then went to the road races, which was anything from 10K up to marathon distance, and marathon being the full distance that the runners do, the 42 kilometres. But for me, you know, of course, when I changed that, I changed a lot of training, my eating habits and a lot of different things to be able to be competitive over that distance. But, you know, the Boston Marathon was the one that everyone, you know, wanted to win. It was the most prestigious at the time, had the most prize money, and it was just the one that everyone thought, yeah, Boston, if you won Boston, then, you know, you kind of made it. So, of course, I looked at that and thought, hey, rightio, got to win Boston Marathon. It did take me 5 years to do it, or 6 years, because on the 6th attempt, so I did win Boston. But for me, there was almost winning that race was beating one particular person, a lady called Jean Driscoll, who was an American athlete. And every time Jean had entered the race, literally entered it, she won it. So it was like, wow, okay, there's just this amazing person that I have to try and beat, let alone, you know, do the distance and the hills and everything else with the race. It was just this one person that was just so phenomenal. I set myself those goals. As you do.
What an awesome rival to have.
Yeah, I did conquer it a few times and we had a great rivalry and it was fantastic the way it played out in the media over there.
You say conquered it, but you won the Boston Marathon 4 times, mate. I think that's more than just conquered it.
Well, once you do it once, you go, oh, I've got to come back and do it again.
You got to back it up.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a fluke. Come on.
Hey, Louise, what are you thinking about when you are on the track or when you are in the middle of a marathon? Where's your mind at?
Yeah, good question. I suppose it determines which race that you're actually doing, I suppose. In a marathon, you've got obviously a lot more time to think and have, you know, prepare, and you've got the course, and depending on where you are in the course and your competitors and where you want to try and break away and all those kind of things, you've got those things to think about. It takes a lot longer, but say in an 800, which is just 2 laps of the track, there's not a lot of time to think. You've really got to be able to make decisions very quickly and stick to race plans and know your weaknesses and strengths very clearly. For me, always on the start line of a track race, I would definitely be extremely nervous and trying to convince myself of my worth, I suppose, to a certain extent, that you've trained for this, you know what you're doing and you know your race plan. So I had to convince myself that I was confident enough to do it, because you just get so nervous doing things like that at such a world stage. Your mind sometimes does drift all over the place, but you've really got to try and hone in and focus on why you're there, what you're doing, and believing in yourself that you can actually do it.
Yeah, a bit of positive self-talk never hurt anybody.
Oh, absolutely. I think I've done a lot of that in the past.
One of the things that I am always curious about, Louise, and it's not just athletes who compete with a disability, but athletes across all different codes who require equipment when they compete. As somebody who's travelled across the world, what kind of gear are you taking with you?
Ooh. I know there's a lot of sports that struggle a lot more than we do, but, travelling with a bunch of guys with race chairs sometimes creates its own interesting things that happen all over the world. But, normally we take our own race chairs and a race chair, spare wheels, obviously luggage bags and things like that. And it can be quite difficult when you're the only person at the airport and, yeah, it gets a bit hectic. And also travelling in large groups as well, the amount of luggage and stuff that you've got to take and sometimes, you know, find it difficult to get through airports and obviously getting away with excess luggage too sometimes can be a bit full on, but I know other sports face their own dramas as well with regards to equipment. It's very expensive, and having things damaged as well is obviously not the greatest outcome when you've travelled halfway around the world and then you simply can't compete because an airline has crushed your chair or wheels or things have become broken, not only in your sporting equipment, but the, you know, everyday chair that I sit in, you're kind of a little bit stuffed if you get to the other end and your chair's not in one piece.
So has that happened to you before?
Yeah, that's happened, and also that it's just simply not turned up because, you know, why would they put us on the plane? Being a little sarcastic there, but it does happen, and it has happened quite a number of times, unfortunately. Don't seem to see the value or the importance in it sometimes, which is extremely frustrating.
Extremely frustrating. It's also, like you said, an absolute essential part of your everyday. But if you're on a world stage competing, it's just, it's a requirement. It's a piece of you, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I get on almost any plane and you kind of cross your fingers and hope for the best and that you get to the other end with everything in one piece, and especially your everyday chair that you sit in, but definitely your sporting equipment. A lot of the guys now have specialised cases that they put their race chairs in because it's simply too much of a risk now to, you know, and too much at stake to not get there and have your equipment in one piece. We take a few more extreme measures, but often you can't do that with the chair that you're sitting in.
One that's a little bit closer to home was the 2000 Sydney Olympic and Paralympic Games being hosted in your own country. Not only were you competing, but you also had the call up to light the Paralympic cauldron. What were the first thoughts running through your mind when that phone call came through?
Yeah, well, that was extremely interesting. I remember 4 years earlier and a friend of mine was carrying the torch in Atlanta, and I thought, oh, wow, wouldn't that be cool to do in 4 years' time, you know? And then we were actually in the village getting ready for the games and in Sydney, and we were told to come to the stadium, and the last six torchbearers were announced, and it was a secret. We were all very excited, and we were there for a rehearsal for the opening ceremony, and they said, oh, well, don't you want to know who's actually lighting the cauldron? And none of us had even occurred to us. We were just so excited that we get to be the last six torchbearers. But yeah, I was announced at that time that I was going to actually be lighting it, and it was a massive secret. I wasn't allowed to tell just about anybody, and I didn't actually tell my family either, which was a great surprise for them as well. You know, I marched out with the team and then was, you know, whisked off to, let me say, the bathroom to get ready for my role in the opening ceremony of actually lighting the cauldron. And of course, you know, everyone was following the torch around the track, and then it came to me in the middle there, and I was the last person and to light it. And back in the day, you know, my sister had the handy cam and she was videoing, and you can hear my mother in the background, you know, saying, oh, the cheeky little bugger, she didn't tell me she was doing that. So it was a great surprise for all of them and a lot of people, that, you know, the honour that I was bestowed with to light the actual cauldron and start the Paralympic Games off in Sydney. It was massive and obviously something I'll never ever forget.
Oh, so phenomenal. Having that home movie is, like, absolutely priceless as well.
Yeah.
Tell us about how the rest of the Sydney 2000 Paralympics went for you. How did you feel about the competition, about it being the world stage but essentially in your own backyard?
There was a lot of pressure, I think, was put on me by some people, but also myself more than anything, to perform. And I think it's any athlete's dream, I suppose, to have a home games in the prime of their career. And that's where I was at. And I thought, wow, this is something so unique and phenomenal. But again, a lot of pressure put on myself. And my first race was an 800, which I was, of course, favoured to win. And there's a little controversy in the lead up with a crash, and the final went ahead, and I did not win the 800. So, you know, my first race, I didn't win gold, and you know, there was a lot of talk about that. But I did go on to compete in two other events on the track and did win gold. I would have to say, not only my personal achievements at the Games, but I was just so proud to be Australian. The way the Paralympics were put on, all the preparations, the organising committees that worked between the Olympics and Paralympics, and the educational process that went into the Paralympics in the schools, the school children that attended, the international athletes coming up to me during the games and saying, this is amazing. You know, we're on the front page, the back page of the paper with a headline, you know, news story on the nightly news. This is unbelievable. You know, the basketball stadium, the rugby, it's all the tennis. It's the capacity. this doesn't happen for athletes with disability sport. And so for me, that just made me so proud of the way Australia had embraced the Paralympics and also showcased us. And I feel like it was a massive turning point for Paralympic Games and how it's carried on and gone forward to bigger and better things. So extremely proud that we did that in Australia and showed the world how a Paralympic Games should be and how it should be for the athletes and the respect that they deserve. That made me extremely proud to be Australian and to know that we've done such a bloody good job.
It was such a good job, and I feel like years since the 2000 Paralympics, it's only grown and grown, and support has just expanded exponentially. Tokyo is a perfect example of that. I want to talk about that shortly. Was it around the 2000 period, Louise, where you maybe started to notice that this public attention or people were really starting to take notice of who you were and your skill as an athlete?
Absolutely. We gained such great public profile, and for me it was like, well, how do we maximize this? How do we keep this going? I want this to carry forward for future generations and to have those opportunities and for it to get bigger and better. And that's still what I want now. Definitely, I want to see it grow and I want to see it to even, become on par with a lot of other sports, which would be ideal. We can never have enough publicity, let's face it. Yeah, definitely 2000 brought it to light, and as you said, it's grown and grown. And Tokyo was a prime example of that, yes.
Well, it's grown so much, and I can see that you wanted to maximise it so much that in 2002 you published your autobiography, Louise Sauvage, My Story. Was there a particular moment in time, or was there a particular story or message that you wanted to capture and share with everybody in that book?
Yeah, at the time I probably was like, wow, a book, really? Should I be doing this kind of thing? But it was put towards me that, there wasn't anybody out there that had a book in a similar situation or had been to a Paralympics like that. I think it was important to document it, and probably one of the biggest moments in my life as well, but also to show what I went through and different things that I did at the time. And I suppose the message more than anything was just an athlete journey, but an athlete journey that hadn't been told before. And Ian Heads, who wrote the book with me, who's absolutely brilliant. He's a phenomenal sports writer, and delving into someone else's story is what he does best and tells it through perfectly, I suppose, through my eyes and my words. And it's funny, the people that know me who've read the book are going, yeah, I can hear you talking. So it was fantastic. He did a marvellous job, and I'm very proud of it. But I don't think we'll be doing a sequel somehow. It's a lot of work. I didn't even write it all.
Well, that leads into my next question, is will there ever be another book, maybe not a sequel, but maybe on your time as a coach?
I'm not sure. At this stage, I'd have to say no. I'm not sure Ian would be up for it. I'd have to ask him, but you never know. But, yeah, that would be fantastic, maybe just to show I've been coaching now for 17 years and achieved my coaching goal this year of coaching a Paralympic gold medalist. Yeah, that was something that I'd strived for the whole time and had a goal to do. Yeah, never say never, hey?
Louise, when was the moment for you when you decided to retire yourself from a career of racing as an athlete?
Yeah, 2004, I retired after the Athens Paralympic Games. At the beginning of that year, I wasn't really sure whether I'd make the games or not. Unfortunately, just the repetitive nature of my sport and the amount of work that I'd put my shoulders and everything else through meant that, I carried a number of injuries. So I had to make, let's say, a sensible decision for once in my life about whether I should, retire and actually think about my future of having to be able to get around for the rest of my life using my upper body. So we decided, after a lot of considerations that year, I would try and make it to Athens and do the best I possibly could, doing a lot of quality work and not quantity and being in the best shape I possibly could. So I knew that I had to retire after those games. So it was, it's kind of good and bad that that you're going to retire, and you can kind of prepare a little bit, obviously mentally, and try and figure out what you want to do post-games as well.
It's always sad when you have to stop doing the thing that you know you're so good at and you know that you love, but you are a coach now. You have been, like you said, for 17 years. Was it almost like a bittersweet goodbye or passing of the baton?
A little bit. It also comes to the fact that I achieved just about everything that I wanted to in my sport, and that I did get such a buzz out of helping others and achieving their goals. And for me, I did want to stay involved in my chosen sport if I could. And I thought a way of doing that would be to coach. I didn't know if I'd be any good at coaching, but I thought I'd give it a crack, so to speak, and see whether I could do that and to give back to the sport that had given me so much, the opportunities that I've had, and, you know, to see the world, have great friends, and just the experience is just phenomenal. So I'd really like to see other people to have, you know, those opportunities. And you know, not everyone's going to get to a Paralympic level, but the opportunity to participate in sport and have a good time and be social and physically active is probably one of the most great benefits of sport. You know, it can be for all levels and enjoyment. For me, yeah, being involved in my chosen sport still, and you know, I have such great passion for it. So it was a no-brainer in the end, and turns out I was all right as a coach.
It's an interesting concept, that idea of, like, a lot of people, especially adults now, they engage in sport, usually in social sport, as a means of some exercise and to catch up with some mates. I know that I definitely do that. I have a social netball team. But when you come from a absolute professional, top of their game athlete level, and then decide that it's time to retire before heading into coaching, was there ever a period where you thought, I'm not going to be able to come back and do this socially, or I'm not going to be able to reconnect in that way? Or have you been able to make that transition back to a more social sort of aspect of sport?
Yeah, I think it's been well documented. A lot of athletes that are at the top of their game and either are forced into retirement or retire because of injuries, or, yeah, physically just can't do it anymore. It's their time. There's so many different reasons why people retire, but I think once you've been at the top level and you've been very good at what you do, I think it's very hard to figure out what the next step is. And I think for me, I did struggle with that. Losing something that, like I said, you're very good at, you've got your structure, you know how to do it, perfect. It's like starting all over again, and it's a great loss. I think it has been documented a number of athletes that lose their way and turn to different things and perhaps get on a different path and not the best path for themselves. I think mentally, more than anything, it's very difficult to move forward. I did struggle myself, definitely, in that transition, and also the physical nature of it. Like, you know, I physically can't do what I used to be able to do, and obviously I'm getting older now, but I carry a lot of those injuries forward, and it's frustrating. It's very frustrating. I'd love to be out there still doing racing, and I'd still love to be out there doing everything. But, yeah, body slows down, unfortunately. I'm still fairly active, but I don't compete in almost anything now, unfortunately. I don't think my body would like that very much. The mind's willing, just the body's not.
Can totally relate to that. Who was supporting you through that period, Louise? And who supports you now?
I'm very fortunate, you know, where I work, and obviously they were a big supporter of me when I was an athlete as well. You know, I do work for the New South Wales Institute of Sport. A lot of the institutes and academies around the country now have some great programs in terms of supporting their athletes post-retirement and helping them, you know, guide them through the different situations that they might come to. And there's a lot of mentor programs as well, which is fantastic. And I know I'm part of a couple of those too, to try and help athletes. So for me, you know, I did look towards some of those people that had been through the situation of retirement before me, and asked them for advice, and some different people around the places through, as I said, the Institute and Academy network, which were fantastic. They really did help me. And, of course, you've always got your family and friends that are always there to support you and also ground you at many different times in your life and try and help you through. But I did find a lot of solace in other athletes that had been through similar situations, because they understood and different ways that they had coped. So it was great to talk to them.
So you decide that it's time to retire in 2004. After that, though, you didn't really stop. You were still quite busy. Coaching was the next natural step for you, including team coach for the Beijing Paralympics, the 2011 IPC Championships, and the 2014 Commonwealth Games. Just a couple of the coaching endeavours that you've had. What was the transition like to go from competing and being on the track to then being in a coaching position and really a position of mentorship?
yeah, different world on the other side. I think Beijing was probably one of my toughest, just because a lot of athletes that I competed against 4 years earlier were still out there competing, and I struggled with that, not being able to do it myself, and probably wasn't the best coach. But it's a learning curve. I'm still learning. You know, I'll never stop, if that means, you know, you're continuously changing and learning. It's a different world. I think it's easier being an athlete half the time than being a coach, and all the different things that, you know, you deal with, you know, on the other side with regards to all the paperwork and all the preparations and so many different things that you didn't know happened as an athlete. To get to where you are and get you to competition, and there's so many different things that we do now. It's been an interesting transition, but also great to have my knowledge as an athlete and bringing that into how I'd really like to see the future as well, and having that impact and ability to be able to have that impact. Yeah, it's fantastic to still be involved and to help in that respect. And I feel like also being a coach, ex-athlete, and being a coach now, I have a different communication level with the athletes. They automatically know that I know how they feel. They don't have to explain anything. I know how nervous they are. I know what it's like to do a lot of things that they're trying to do and competing at that level. So it's great to be able to have that level with them and know what they potentially need at that time. It's definitely a different world being on this side, but you know, it's just another challenge, I suppose. Yeah, trying to embrace it.
One of the absolute pinnacles of success in coaching is, of course, Madison De Rosario, who you coached this year to achieve a gold medal at the 2020 Tokyo Paralympic Games. We say 2020 and we say this year because, yeah, of course, there was a bit of a debacle. Talk us through sort of what the last 18 months have looked like for you and Madison, Louise. I imagine there's been a lot of false starts, a lot of are we coming or going, and confusion that's thrown it all into a bit of chaos.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. Obviously, the games being postponed by 1 year did throw most people, and it was something that obviously we didn't exactly know whether it was going to happen or whether it wasn't going to happen, as you said. And once the decision was made to postpone it by a year, I really had to try and switch the mindset of the athletes to be like, okay, we're all devastated. Yes, we've been preparing for this, but we've got to really try and turn it around and see the positives. And the positives were that we had more time to prepare. We could try different things. We could use different equipment. We could have an opportunity. And, of course, obviously with COVID, we're not being able to travel and things like that, where Madison is usually travelling around the world competing in so many different races. We had the opportunity to stay home and really prepare and do a large block of training work and a base work, which we don't always get to do. So that was probably one of the positives we had to look at, definitely, and that we could get faster and we could be stronger and we had more time to prepare. So we tried very hard to look at the positives. There were a lot of negatives, unfortunately, that presented the ever-changing situation that we found ourselves in. I love a good plan at the best of times, but it was very difficult to plan ahead, given for us lockdowns off and on and having facilities closed and open and not being able to do this or that. So we did find it very difficult in the lead up. But, you know, again, we just tried to make the most of everything that we had on offer to us, and very appreciative to the facilities that did stay open for us to prepare the best we could right up until we left Australia. But not being able to compete or, you know, have that race practice, things like that, was not great for us. It was very detrimental, and I feel for the team sports more than anything, that really struggled with that more than anything, not being able to do camps and things like that. It worked out okay in the end. We did get a couple of wins, so
it definitely did pay off, all the hard work and the waiting around as well. I mean, you have been in that exact position where Madison was. You've crossed the finish line so many times with gold medals in tow. On the other end, as the coach, watching Madison pass that line and get her gold medal, how did that feel for you?
Oh, probably relief more than anything. I think you get very stressed out. You try not to let that go. But I don't know. I think it's just a definitely not only relief, but to know that you've done all that hard work, and she knows and I know that the effort and the time and all those little things that you do, and it's just so worthwhile. to be part of someone else's journey and to know what it means to them and to yourself. And yeah, it's phenomenal to have that, and the reward is so high. Yeah, but it is very stressful, I won't deny it, especially the marathon in Tokyo.
Louise, one of the other things that we talked about way back at the beginning of this conversation was about the idea of Paralympic sport and Paralympic athletes being absolutely embraced. We know that the Paralympics has gone from strength to strength. And one of the things that really stood out about Tokyo 2020 was when the government announced the Paralympic medalists would be paid the same as Olympic medalists. Can you speak, as somebody who has competed as a Paralympic athlete for many years, can you tell us about the significance of that decision?
It is massive. It's fantastic that people realise that, you know, it's not the same, and our funding and everything else is not the same as the able-bodied athletes in so many different realms. And, you know, it is from a different source of money. The AOC, which is the Australian Olympic Committee, is the people that were paying the medals. We're not part of that. It's very different. We don't have the funds. Paralympics Australia don't have the funds to be able to pay our medalists. So it was fantastic that the government said, well, no, we can do that. It would be fantastic for them to be able to be treated exactly the same. So that was a very much a groundbreaker for us to be able to see that. And talking to Priya Cooper, we were all just like, well, where's the back payment? So it was great.
They would go absolutely bankrupt if they had to pay you, I reckon.
Oh, come on. that would be fantastic. But yeah, definitely, it was definitely a groundbreaker for us, and to know that, yeah, that they would do that. I must ask if that's actually happened yet or not.
I think it's so well overdue. And I think a lot of people, it wasn't a matter of the people wanted to deny this, but I think just a lot of people maybe actually had no idea that was happening and the disparity.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I do think that you're absolutely correct in terms of people don't realise the disparity between, which, you know, a lot of times has been the case, and it's getting closer and closer. But, you know, we're two different organisations. That's why the Olympics is a very separate event to the Paralympics, and two different organising committees or back here in Australia that look after the games and the preparations for the athletes. It's a good to educate people and to know that it's not all the same. We don't get the same uniforms. We don't get the same lots of different things. So, yeah, it's a good way of further education and about the differences between Olympics and Paralympics.
I just want to change pace for a moment, Louise. We've talked a lot about sport, a lot about your professional career as both an athlete, a competitor and a coach. But off the track, there's been lots of other achievements in your life, including at just 20 years old, you received an OAM. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, the Paralympic gold medalists were to receive the OAM title, and I was a gold medalist in 1992, and, yeah, I probably didn't realise exactly what it meant at the time. And, of course, thank goodness my family did. But it was, you know, a huge honour to have that bestowed on me. It's great honour, obviously. I went on and competed many more times after that. Yeah, having an award or two is very, very special, and it's not everyone that gets that. So, yeah, hopefully Madison will get that now. Who knows? Obviously something that's very special. I'm just privileged to have that.
Well, that and a number of awards and accolades as well, including Australian Female Athlete of the Year in not just 1997, but also 98 and 99. You've also received the Wheelchair Athlete of the Year award in 99 and 2000. The late 90s were a really busy time for you, weren't they?
Yeah. And it's funny though, you know, you kind of get these awards, and, you know, obviously the recognition is phenomenal, just to know that not only, you know, your performances on the day, but also since I've retired, has been bestowed with a number of awards as well. You know, you don't expect it once you stop racing. So it is fantastic to be recognised and to put in the same realm as so many other amazing sporting athletes. Yeah, again, just extremely honoured to be recognised at that level.
There's two more that I want to talk to very briefly, and one of those is in 2007 you were inducted into the Sports Australia Hall of Fame, and in 2019 they went a step further and elevated you to legend status, making you the first Paralympian to be elevated in the Australian Hall Sports of Fame. Can you tell us, Louise, as the first Paralympian to be granted that accolade, how significant is that?
It's huge. I mean, not just for myself, but for all athletes with disabilities. I was the first to be inducted in the Sport Australia Hall of Fame. And then after that, you know, a few years later, I was actually asked to be part of the selection committee, which I'm still part of now, that, you know, helps decide on the next inductees and the next legends and things like that. And to be granted legend status as well is amazing. There's not many of us, just over 40 of us in Australia. So for me, that is just, yeah, the highest honour that I could have actually got in, you know, the sporting realm, especially for Australia. And to know that I'm part of this esteemed club, I could say, is just phenomenal. And it's a wonderful feeling to know that you're respected in that way. And, yeah, you're part of it on an equal footing. And I think, again, it just leads the way for more athletes with a disability to know that you are included and you are accepted and you are recognised for your sporting achievements, not just simply because you have a disability, but because of what you've achieved. For me, that was, yeah, one of the highest honours I could have ever gotten. I'm so privileged and happy and honoured to be part of that group. And, yeah, you got to pinch yourself when you go to those dinners. Unfortunately, we haven't had one for a couple of years now, but I look forward to when we can all get together again and to know that I deserve to be in that room and to be part of it all. So, yeah.
Your contribution has been astronomical to not just Australian sport and to people living with a disability, but to young women out there who maybe are like yourself, Louise, sitting there on the sideline of community sport that's going on in their schools and thinking, hey, maybe I could be a part of this. I mean, when you found wheelchair racing, the rest is history. So to think that could be potentially the goal out there for somebody like a Madison De Rosario is just, it's phenomenal.
Absolutely. And I don't think, you know, anybody, you know, female, male, disability, non-disability, doesn't really matter. I think you contribute in so many different ways. And I think the most important thing is to know that the small things count. You know, all those little things that you did or the person that obviously got me involved in sport and the person that invited us to a come and try day. And that just started it for me. And it was because of that person that helped me get my first race chair, that, you know, gave me something, lent me a pair of gloves or, you know, it's all those things that make a difference. And don't think that your contribution is ever small, because it's not. You never know what's going to happen. And even if you just put a smile on someone's face because they're out there enjoying themselves, then it's so worth it. Absolutely. Everything is worth it.
One of the other ones, of course, and the reason that this podcast exists right now, is your induction to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. You're one of the inaugural inductees in 2011. When you received that email or that phone call, what was that response like?
Oh, it's just, you know, again, I just can't believe to be, you know, obviously recognised in my home state and to be part of an elite group as well. Just, you know, the recognition to know that it's come from that is just, yeah, it's great. And I just think, it again, like you said, it paves the way and shows what is possible for me. Again, another honour which I'm extremely proud of, to know that, you know, maybe I was a bit of a groundbreaker, and it to show what is possible. Yeah, it was just fantastic, and I love it all.
That's what I want to hear. The Tokyo Paralympics have been and gone now. Your coaching is, I don't want to say it's done and dusted for the year, because I know that those things never fully end. But what's next for you? What are you spending your days and your attention on now?
Oh, well, the cycle continues. There's always something new. And I know Madison is heading off and she'll compete in some other road races this year. And then, of course, we focus our attention on to next year and hopefully being able to travel a lot more freely and be able to compete overseas again. We do have some limited events at the Commonwealth Games next year. And, of course, we have World Championships. And then long term, obviously Paris, which is a shorter turnaround than normal, so only 3 years away. So next Paralympic Games, and you know, hopefully we'll be bigger and better and stronger and give it another crack and see what we can do.
It'll be back before you even realise.
Yes, unfortunately. No time, no rest for the weekend. We'll keep going and see what we can do next.
Louise, I reckon that you probably have some absolute anthems on your motivation, your training playlist. We're a radio station first and foremost, and as part of all these interviews, we've been asking people for a song recommendation or an artist they love so we can sort of tie that into these episodes. Have you got a recommendation for us?
Oh, gosh, put me on the spot. I remember in Sydney 2000, I had to pick a song for a CD they were putting together, and I was fortunate to meet the artist in the end, and that was Jimmy Barr. Oh, yeah. And my song was No Second Prize, and it kind of plays it. Means a lot because I'm was always there to win.
Oh, my gosh, it's so. The Louise Sauvage anthem.
So, yeah, it was kind of cool to meet Jimmy and, you know, pick his song. And, yeah, that was probably something that I always loved.
Oh, I'm so here for it. I reckon if we can play Take Me Home Country Road, we can play some Jimmy Barnes on RTRFM for sure.
Awesome. Love it.
It might be the only time.
Awesome. That's great. I appreciate that.
Louise Sauvage, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really, really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me. And, yeah, I really appreciate the support.
Thanks to Louise Sauvage and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And we couldn't do this without a big thank you to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer and editor is Danae Gibson. Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomaeus and Sophie Minisale are the assistant producers. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for episode 11.